The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hey, this is Captain Lee, and you're listening to the Andertons podcast. Hey, everybody, welcome back to Andertons TV. I've got an amazing guest today. Someone who has toured and played on records with, you know, so many of my favourite artists. I've discovered one of the most amazing gigs I ever went to. Phil was on stage at the time. So, Phil Palmer, everybody, welcome to Andertons.
Hi, everybody.
Yes, you're looking ever so well. I'm guessing the Italian sunshine agrees with you.
It does, yeah. I mean, it got a bit hot this summer because in Rome it got to 42 at some points. But it's nice to be back in a moderate climate in a bit of peace and quiet.
Oh, well, look, that's nice. Okay, so let's dive in. The potted history, for people that aren't familiar with you, are you have two exceptionally famous uncles who introduced you to the electric guitar.
Yeah.
And you've gone on to have a lunatically successful career through, you know, my favourite probably decade of music. You know, that I think that last decade of supergroups and crazy production albums. But can we take us back? I've also been told, by the way, that Phil's very modest, and I know most of the artists I think you've played of, but maybe not all of them. So please feel free to, you know, blow your own trumpet a bit during this interview.
Okay.
But yeah, so take us back then. Tell the people who are your famous family members and what was that like growing up around them?
Okay, yes. Ray and Dave Davis, uncles, my mother's brothers. I grew up, obviously, with them. And our age differences were not that huge. I think Ray is only 74 now, 75, and I'm 69.
Right.
So, I was following them growing up. I was watching them as they evolved into the Kinks. They were originally called the Ravens.
Okay.
And I remember going to see them at a place called the Athenaeum in Muswell Hill when I was about 8, 9 probably. And it was, I thought, this is very exciting, rock and roll. I want to be part of this. And I think the whole music thing was born for me there. I mean, it was early days of technology with records. We used to play 78s on my grandmother's gramophone in her front room every Saturday, and I used to watch these things whizzing round and listen to, you know, the Everly Brothers on 78 and Eddie Cochran and Jerry Lee Lewis and all this amazing stuff. All this information was coming into me, and the Kinks evolved into the Kinks about 1962, and I was 10. And they started to have some success, and I used to watch them go up the motorway in their old Thames van with all the equipment in the back, and I thought, this is the life for me. And I think I was sold on it right then.
I mean, my dad is same age as, I guess, Ray is, and I kind of feel like what a magical time that must have been to go from that real first wave of British pop, I suppose, you know, pop, yeah, rock kind of stuff. And the Kinks were just, you know, pioneers, I suppose, of that whole scene. So was that your, you know, was that your first introduction to the guitar? Were they literally sort of, you know, I'll give you a few lessons, Phil, or were you interested anyway?
No, it was my Uncle Mike.
Right.
Who taught all of us, actually. He taught me and Dave and me. and he was a Chet Atkins fan. And it's been very interesting, you know, researching for the book that we'll talk about later, how many people were influenced by Chet Atkins at that time, yeah. During the 50s. And so Uncle Mike was the teacher for all of us, and we learned little Chet Atkins pieces when I was a kid. And then I started to get interested in the blues thing, and I remember listening to Big Bill Brunsey when I was very young, and finding a piece of film, I think I saw it on TV or something, of him performing in a nightclub in Paris, I think it was, and just being fascinated by his technique, which I'm still trying to perfect. I mean, I've been working on it ever since then, and it's particular. It's the guys that were playing guitar around then, like Chet Atkins and like Big Bill Brunsey, had a technique where it was like a one-man band in a way. They had a rhythm going, they were playing the bass line and they were playing a top line all at the same time. And I thought, that's really difficult.
Yeah.
And it is really difficult.
Yeah.
But both of them, Chet Atkins and Big Bill Brunsey, had that technique of sounding like it was a band playing, you know. And I think that's what fascinated me.
What were your, what kind of kit did you have back then to play on? Because this is presumably pre the sense that, you know, Fender or anything like that was available in the shops. Would you, did you have classic old catalogue type guitars that would have been available over here?
I think I had a Vox,
okay.
Phantom, which was a present from Dave.
Yeah.
Which is shaped a bit like a 50 pence piece.
Yeah.
Which got lost somewhere along the way, which I still had it because it was... It wasn't a great guitar to play on, but it was a special thing.
Yeah.
And I had an Echo acoustic 12-string, which is what I pretty much learnt on from the age of about 6 or 7.
Oh, so you were a young starter then, because I was trying to gauge kind of, you know, were you... So yes, introduction to guitar from a really young age.
Ukulele.
Right.
When I was 5, I got a ukulele. Brilliant. My mum bought me a ukulele when I was 5, and I learnt Little Brown Jug from a little book that came with it, 3 chords, and mum was very proud.
That's brilliant.
Yeah.
I don't want to go all sort of nostalgic and just sort of say, you know, how much, not necessarily easier it is to learn to play now, but, you know, the idea of, you know, you're on YouTube and you just go, I want to learn to play guitar, and 10 million people will go, here's some great free content, you know, like you say, I had a ukulele, a book. I mean, I remember Bert Whedon's Play in a Day, you know, that was my sort
not
of introduction.
True.
Huh?
It's not true.
What, you can't play in a day? Yeah, no, you definitely find that at the end of the first day. And I know my granddad knew Bert, and it was, but anyway, actually, in fairness, I'm probably not quite that old. You know, that sense of, that was how you learned, wasn't it? You got probably a pretty crappy guitar and a book that was written by someone that was probably 50 years older than you at the time, and
yep.
Off you go.
That's but, pretty much it, yeah.
So let's talk about then through the teens. Are you in London at the time then? Is this where you were growing up? Sorry,
Muswell
you said
Muswell Hill, yeah.
So Kingston. Pretty amazing scene at that time. And did you have the right haircut and everything at school, and you're thinking, this is me, I'm going to be the next...
Yeah, I was not
John
popular,
Lennon,
not
George
a popular
Harrison.
Student. My headmaster used to shout at me for having long hair and flared trousers. But, yeah, I mean, it was a revolution really going on. And I got swept up in it, along with my friend Brian. And Brian was my kind of competition, and we both learnt together. And we would challenge each other by finding new things to play, like David Graham and, you know, some...
I'm waiting for you to clang Brian's surname as to be sort of like, are we talking...
He was a purist, Brian, and he never developed into anything. He didn't want to do it professionally, and I did. That was a difference.
Well, so that's okay. What's in the your, you know, DNA and your psyche that just went, okay? Because I can imagine as well at that time, I certainly, you know, I remember my, you know, my dad who was a professional drummer for a short period of time, but really not in the style that his dad wanted him to, you know. There was a real sense of, you know, the music at the time was quite rebellious and not necessarily as accepted as maybe it is now. So did you feel that in society in terms of, or I mean, the fact that your mum's two brothers were, you know, like rock and roll sort of Kings, you know, was there a sense that your family was very open to you being a professional musician?
My dad was not too keen on the idea. My dad was a policeman, and he was quite anti. And he'd seen what was evolving, you know, with the drug scene in the early 60s with the Kinks and stuff. So he'd seen the bad side of it. And he was quite worried that I might get swept up in that, which I must say I never did. But I never did, probably because of him. Mm. You know, he was always in the back of my mind saying, you don't want to do this stuff. And so it was a pretty pretty nervous adolescence in a way, because I was always watching for the old man. And, you know, by the time I was 16 or 17, I was already in little bands and running around and doing stuff. And I remember a confrontation with Dad when I came home at 6 o'clock in the morning, just as he was going to work. And he said, listen, you've got to give up this pop lark, or you'd have to find somewhere else to live. And it was heavy. It was a little heavy, yeah. And so I did. I moved out when
I was going to say, yes, found somewhere to live as opposed to gave up the pop lark.
Oh, yeah, there was no competition there.
Did you reconcile that with him at some point?
It took a while, but there's a lovely story in the book, actually, because, we kind of drifted apart for a long time, 20 years probably. But then there came a moment where I thought, well, this is probably the right time to try to get back together with Dad. And it was one of the orchestral nights with Eric Clapton at the Albert Hall. And I thought, well, this is a good moment, and you know, it won't be too loud, and it won't be, you know. So I sent a big black car for them, and they arrived, and they got looked after, and put in a box with a bottle of champagne, and I could see them as we were doing the gig, and it's very emotional.
Oh, I bet. That's right. I'm so pleased that, you know, it's important to try and. Every family goes through ups and downs, doesn't it? And I think it's important to make sure you try and put as many of those to bed as you possibly can. So I'm happy for you.
Yeah.
So obviously, you know, your career that at least I know of was playing in other people's bands. But how much time were you trying to do your own band thing? Mm. And how has that sort of, how have you balanced that through your life in terms of balancing what you do personally with what you might, you know, play with other musicians with?
I think I always consciously avoided, you know, giving that sort of attention to my own career. I was very happy just, you know, joining bands and touring the world and doing that stuff. It took the pressure off me a little bit. You know, as a session player, you move from one thing to another daily. I mean, in the early days of sessions, I could do 3 different sessions in one day.
Yeah.
There were 3 hours, you know, and so you'd do the jingle session in the morning, something around lunchtime, and something in the evening. 3 different studios with 3 different artists. So I kind of like that diversity, and I like the challenge of you know, walking into a room of strangers and playing a piece of music and making it work. You know,
how did you get that break? I mean, were you? I know. There's stories I've read back then that there probably weren't that many guys on the session scene then, but you had to have had a break at some point. So what was the break?
The break? Well, there was a few session guitar players around. Big Jim Sullivan was one.
Oh, I love Big Jim.
He was doing a lot of stuff back then, you know.
That was probably before, because I know when I've met, Jim, he passed away a few years ago now, didn't he? But I remember Jim telling stories of, in his day, it was either him or Jimmy Page. They were the only 2 guys that there was. So I'm guessing you must have come along maybe sort of...
Just slightly
towards,
after that, yeah. Now, I got involved in sessions because Uncle Ray opened a studio in 1970, I think it was, around there, called Conk Studios. And they developed a little label, also called Conk Records, and they had a few artists which they signed up to do albums. And Ray would normally produce... And one of the first was a lady called Claire Hamill from County Durham, a lovely girl, great singer, good songs. And I used to sit at the back in the corner of the control room and watch it happen, fascinated by the procedure. And some great players showed up on that. It was Philip Chen was on bass, and Clem Cattini, I think, was the drummer. The keyboard player, I can't remember. Tim Hinckley, maybe.
Right.
Anyway, it was a nice bunch of good players, and I watched them, you know, develop ideas and songs in the studio, and I thought, this is amazing. And I got to know Philip Chen very well, and he gave me some advice. And one day when they were out at dinner, I was noodling in the studio, because Ray had a beautiful old Sunburst Telecaster. I think it must have been a late 50s Telecaster with a white beading around the edge. And I loved that guitar. And I was noodling in the studio just while they were out at dinner. And without me knowing, Claire had come back early, and she was sitting in the control room listening to me play. And she said, "You can play a bit." I said, "I'll do my best." She said, "Can you play in our next track? We need a guitar part there." So she said, "Develop a part and get comfortable with it." And that was the first session I ever did. So that had been about 73, I guess, 74.
So that was in Ray's studio, and that was there a light bulb moment? Were you trying to balance a normal job with that at the time, or were you already able to be full time?
I reluctantly took a job because Dad was nagging me, and I worked in a little factory in Colindale called Romac. And it was, they made rubber products for the car trade. And so I was doing that, and I was doing gigs in the evening and running around doing all kinds of stuff. But it didn't last very long, the job. Yeah.
Well, I'm pleased. So this was early 70s now. I think I kind of pick up your career probably 80s. So can we fill in the sort of 70s, the rest of the 70s, in terms of, you know, what you were doing? And it seems for me, you know, it's a big old leap to go from being asked to play, you know, a guitar part on that first session, you were saying, with an artist that I don't suppose many people would be familiar with, to some of the names that you know, you're playing with not long after that. So what was that sort of, you know, mid to late 70s in your career?
It was all sessions, basically. Right. Occasional gigs. I mean, I think I went on the road with Claire Hamill for a little while with that same bunch of guys. And it was good grounding, you know, because they were great players. And, you know, to understanding how to do a gig, yes. You know, sort of some kind of rapport with the audience and the other members of the band, and learning how to feel comfortable with it. And it's something that I'm very grateful for, because you know, kids today, a young musician today doesn't have that. You know, you can't play at the pub anymore, you know, like we did. You know, there was a pub circuit, there was sessions, there was, you know, interaction. And I feel sorry for the young players that can't find, you know, someone to bounce off.
It moves on, doesn't it? I think you're right that, you know, I meet some insanely talented guitar players who've got incredibly good at playing behind their video camera, so exactly. They can make videos for YouTube, and might be in this environment here. And there might be a bit where you go, "Shall we?" And it's like, no, I'm not jamming. It's like, what do you mean you're not jamming? It's just like, I don't jam. It's like, that's kind of it's sad, really, isn't it? Because it's sort of, isn't that the sort of
huge
like
part
half
of it.
The joy, isn't it? But
yeah, one of the things I say to young guitar players, you know, I do a few kind of university things, music schools and stuff in Italy a lot, is okay, pick up a guitar and play me 4 inversions of C major, because that for me is much more important than being able to, you know, fly around the fretboard, you know.
You are from the school of working guitar players, where it's chords for dough, solos for show, right?
Kind of, I suppose. Is it true? I don't know.
I've oversimplified that, but being able to sit in a band in a pocket, you know, play to the song, is so much more important than being able to do the flash.
Yeah, I mean, it's something you can't learn sitting at home in front of your TV, I don't think. not successfully anyway. You need to be in a room with other musicians and understand, you know, groove and taste. You know, a lot of younger, as you say, there's some amazing young players out there, but it's about taste. It's about the notes you don't play sometimes. Who's it said? Beautiful quote. Claude Debussy.
Right.
Said something 200 years ago, whatever. He said, music is the space between the notes. And I think that is so true. I think the older I get and the more experienced I get at playing, it's you know, to find one note that will go through three chord changes is much more important to me than trying to join them all together.
Yeah. Well, there'll be a ton of people watching this that will resonate with that. Come on, I feel like I need to get my virtual, you know, name drop horn out here, because we're going to go into the 80s now. And I know you're not going to want to do this because I know how modest you are, but come on. I mean, A, what was the first crazy big one? What was the first one where you went to the studio with Butterflies thinking, what the hell am I doing here?
You know, it was such a gradual curve. I don't think I ever...
Really?
I ever got nervous, no. I suppose the first major artist that I worked with was David Essex.
Okay.
And that was been in the mid-70s. And we did a few albums and a couple of world tours. And I liked David. He was a lovely boy, and still is, probably. Yeah. And there's a nice story because, you know, it was a session band, really. I mean, there was a guy called Barry D'Souza was the drummer. It was, the session drummer at the time. Mike Thorne was the bass player, same deal. Who else was there? Alan Wakeman, sax player. And, you know, David kept us on a retainer, mm-hmm. you know, which was, I don't know, 30 quid a week or something, silly. But it was about the time I'd met my first wife and before we were married, and I was looking for my first flat. I was trying to buy my first flat. And I was chatting to David's secretary at the time. It was a lovely lady, long-suffering lady called Madge. And she used to run his office for him. And I was down in the office one afternoon. And I said, I'm trying to get this new flat I've just found. It's all very exciting. And then I'm going to get married and stuff like that. And I said, I've just got to find 1,200 quid for the deposit. She said, oh, yeah, it's tough. So anyway, phone rang the next morning. It was David. He said, you need 1,250 quid. Right? And he said, there's a check at the office waiting for you. And I said, that's amazing. It's such a nice thing to do. Yeah, thank you, David. And he didn't have to do it. And he said, just pay me back out of the gig fees for the next whatever.
100 years.
Yeah. And the first person that came to visit us was David. And we had far too much wine, and he fell asleep on my couch and stayed the night. And it's just a lovely memory of the early days and how friendly it all was back then, you know.
Well, he was a superstar, wasn't he?
He was,
at that stage. Yeah. And then, you know, where next? What was the... Because it's... I mean, shall I... Do we go Dire Straits or do we go George Michael or do we go...
It's a bit of a jump yet.
Yeah.
I think the first kind of serious... thing I did was Joan Armour Trading, which would have been around 1980. Who lives up
I was literally about to say, Joan, I see Joan in Anderton's quite a lot, and I'm always slightly embarrassed that I'm the only member of staff that actually knows who she is. You know, it's like, I think it's this generational thing like that. But she never, you know, there's never a sense of, don't you know who I am or anything like that. You know, so
she's a very, very laid-back lady. Yeah. She's lovely. And that's that. I think that was probably the first kind of high profile I did. It was a musical band, and she was very musical, and it wasn't pop anymore.
No.
It was a little bit more deep than working with David Essex. But so that was 81, 82, and we did an album called To the Limit, which was quite a big album for her. It was produced by Glyn Johns, who at the time was probably the biggest producer on the planet. You know, he'd done the Eagles and Zeppelin and all kinds of people, and it was, I think I was probably more nervous about working for him
right
than anybody prior to that. So apart from maybe Frank Zappa, which was a little bit stressful.
Kalang! Fair enough. Okay, it's getting good now, isn't it, basically, because it's where it's just going to be a clang fest. So come on, so Joan, and then where are we going?
Yeah, that involved, we did a world tour with Joan in 1982 called The Key Tour, and then I went back to sessions and I started doing, chronologically it's hard to remember, but you know, as you're doing these things, and it's your job, you go and you walk into a session and it goes flying by and you forget about it, you know. And it wasn't until I started writing the book that I started to realise just how much I've been doing, you know. And so, yeah, I think maybe David Sylvian would have been about then.
I'm not sure, even sure I know the name. What was
David Sylvian? Oh, what was he? Very important.
Pop singer? I don't know.
He was in a band called Japan.
Oh, okay. Well, I know Japan.
David Sylvian went solo and did some really amazing albums. And they're really worth a listen. Anybody out there is into something a bit odd.
Like the Japan stuff? Or
no, it was like David Sylvian. It was particular. And he worked with a chap called Ryuichi Sakamoto.
Oh.
Who's a bit of a genius, obviously Japanese, but just a really interesting combination of influences, both of them together, was a bit electric. Oh, I missed out David Bowie. Sorry.
Hang on. I don't think the horn's big enough anymore. What? So what, sessions on a Bowie album?
No, on an Iggy Pop album with David producing. I mean, it was like that. I mean, you get a call and you say, okay, I'll be there, you know, and you walk into the room and there would be whoever it was.
And you didn't get any butterflies?
No.
Wow.
Well,
I got butterflies just doing this interview. I'm just asking the questions.
The Zappa moment was quite interesting.
Come on.
Because nobody knew he was going to be there. But it came through a very good friend of mine, a lovely bass player called Dave Marquis.
Right.
And Simon Phillips was there as well. And a keyboard player called James LaSalle's, I think. And we walked into AdVision Studios at 10 o'clock on a Monday morning in the centre of London. It was raining. To do a session for an Indian violin player called El Shankar.
Okay.
Right. And at the desk was Frank Zappa, you know. And everyone went, that's fucking Frank Zappa. You know, because his reputation was Mothers of Invention, very difficult and complicated music. And we all went, oh, God, you know, we're a bunch of London session players, you know, we're not going to get into that. But it was actually very nice, and he was very nice, and we did a couple of very strange tracks on that album. One which I might try and play in a minute, because it was so complex, the piece. El Shankar, as his name suggests, was Indian.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd written this piece called Darlene, which is based on an Indian raga kind of thing. And it had, the time signature was insane. You know, it was based on a 5/8 pulse, but it would go into 4/4 occasionally, and a 6/8, then an 11/16 bar popped up. And we all struggled with it a lot, you know. It was,
I'm sure I've seen an old BBC Ravi Shankar interview where he talks about Indian music, and it is you almost can't write down the time signatures.
Simon,
flow of some sort.
And that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, you have to kind of feel it. You can't write it down. It's all happening too quick to read. Or even write down. And Simon Phillips was a proper reader, and he couldn't figure it out. So we all sat in a corner in the studio in a circle, clapping like this. And El Shankar was doing this sort of dun 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 to give us the sort of
some
groove.
Sense of rhythm. Yeah.
And after a few hours, probably a whole day actually, we figured out, okay, that's where things happen. There's a push there, and there's this there, and you had to physically get to know the song.
Of all the music I thought you'd be playing, in this interview, I wasn't thinking it would be a sort of a piece of music that you played with an Indian violinist, but hey.
I doubt if I can still play it, but it was so complicated that, let's see.
I mean, bearing in mind you just literally pulled that out from 30 odd years ago or more than that, I'm impressed.
It was one of those things that, you know, it just stayed in there because we did probably 70 takes to get it right. But anybody interested out there, it's a fabulous little piece of music. It's called Darlene by El Shanker and it's from an album called Touch Me There, I think.
Oh, there we go. So come on then, so that's... Frank, that was the Frank Zappa kind of moment. Where are we off to now? And where are we? Mid-80s now, you reckon?
Probably about 1980, yeah.
Oh, okay, early 80s still then,
yeah.
Right?
I'd done a session for, what was his name? Good Earth Studios. Who used to own Good Earth Studios in London? I can't remember his name. Very famous producer. For Ralph McTell.
Right.
It's just one of those, you know, afternoon sessions that I'd just done. And obviously, this guy had connections with David Bowie. What's his name? He's very famous.
I'm rubbish at producers, so apologies. I can't help you here.
Somehow my name got to David Bowie, who was in Berlin producing an album with Iggy Pop, and it became known as The Idiot, and it was a bit of a milestone album. Mm-hmm. There's some great tracks on it. The original China Girl was on there.
Right.
The original of that. And another track called Night Clubbing, which got covered by a few people later on. And I was still at home, okay, so it was 4 o'clock in the morning, the phone rang, and my mum got to the phone before I did. Right, and she came up the stairs and said, "Philip, there's a Mr. Bowie on the phone for you." And I was convinced that it was one of my mates messing around. Yeah, and it was him. And he said, "We'd like you to come to Germany to play on this album." I said, "Okay, fine." And I just took this Telecaster with me. Nocaster, sorry. And I got on the plane 2 days later, and I spent a week in Munich, because they'd moved studios by that point, with David Bowie and Iggy Pop, which was nuts.
Is he as large as life when you're in... That's what you see is what he's like, is it?
Absolutely, yeah. Wow. There was an electricity between the two of them, which was just scary. You know, they used to wind each other up and they used to try things out. And, you know, if you were in the middle of it, it was a difficult place to be. But it was a fascinating energy they had together.
It's just crazy. I mean, in the interest of just trying to sort of get to the current day, we are going to have to move on in the sense of just keep going through all your artists and stuff like that. But I tell you what, we'll talk about that in a minute, but you know, you can get the extended version of this interview, I suggest, in the book. So where are we going now then?
All right, yeah. That would have been after Joan. I went back into the session world and I was probably doing, I don't know, I did some Tears for Fears. I did some Howard Jones, maybe, it was a bit early. I did some Chris de Burgh. Now, Chris de Burgh was a...
bit of Lady in Red.
Yeah, I did Lady in Red. That's me.
Oh, my God. How long was that number one for as well? You're getting into the bit where I, you know, Songs from the Big Chair, didn't everybody of my age, and probably, you know, when it had that album, probably, you know, one of the albums of the 80s.
Yeah, I think it is the album of the 80s.
You're on... like you play on Lady in Red, do you?
I do.
Every, you know, for decades, the first dance at every wedding that there was.
That was my
amazing
idea. Yeah. I'd been listening on the way down to the studio that day. I'd been listening to Marvin Gaye. Came on the radio. I thought, Sexual Healing. Oh, I thought, this is such a great track. And I think I was still thinking of it. I got in the studio, and they said, we got this tune, and we think it's it might be finished, but if you've got any ideas, bung them on. I need a plectrum. I don't think I've got one.
Oh, hang on, I might have some.
Oh, I've got one.
Oh, well done.
And so I started playing this little noodly thing. Something like that. And they said, oh, we like that. Put that on, track it up, and that became The Lady in Red.
That's nuts. That's nuts. What, I mean, and then, okay, just, I can't, keep going. I mean, it's right, nuts, yeah, as well, and it just gets bigger as well, or at least kind of, I think it does. But
okay, there's an important moment happened, I think around 84, 85, and I met and started working with a guy called Paul Brady. And Paul Brady was a fabulous Irish singer-songwriter. And we got on really well, and we did a couple of really nice albums and a couple of really good tours around Europe. And you know, there's footage online of Rock Palace and things like that, the German TV show with us playing. Very young, very kind of a lot of energy. And Brady was amazing. And I suppose towards the end of the 80s, the middle to end of 80s, we'd done quite a lot of work, and we were playing at a club called the Mean Fiddler,
yeah,
in Harlesden in London, and it was a rare London gig for Brady. We'd done all the provinces, we'd done Ireland, we'd done Germany, etc. And Brady was a bit nervous about playing in London, and consequently he was kind of pushing the tempos up and stuff like that. And I'm playing away, and I think I'm playing this. And I looked up, and is Eric Clapton in the audience, right? And my fingers turned into bananas, basically. I couldn't play, because, yeah, you know, so many of my influence had been from him, and you know, a lot of the licks that I play still were stolen from him. I mean, it's all relative, and he's probably stolen from someone else, but that's beside the point. And so I felt very uncomfortable, and he's standing there, and I thought, I can't look at him. But anyway, he came backstage after the show and said hello to everybody. And it turned out that Brady had asked Eric to play on one of his tracks that he was recording, and he just popped along to say hi. It's a track called Deep in Your Heart, which was a really nice tune. And so Eric did that, and literally, it'd been a good year, and so literally me and my wife and my Oliver wasn't born then.
The future is a hefty responsibility, and not one that we take lightly, but then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Was he? Yes, he was. Born in 84. We went to Antigua for a holiday at Christmas. Yeah, it'd been a good year. We'd made a few bob, yeah, and stuff. And I'm sitting on the porch of this little beach hut thing that we were renting, and walking up through the haze in Antigua on the beach, I saw Eric Clapton again, and he had this beautiful young lady on his arm, and I thought, I don't know what to say, and he walked right past the front of me, and he looked at me and he said, you're Phil Palmer, aren't you? Which was, you know, a surprise. And I said, yeah, come in for a cup of tea. And he did, and we got chatting, and he said, after a few, you know, chats about music and influences and stuff, he said, I'm starting to put an album together, and after Christmas I'm going to be going into the studio, and could you pop along? And I said, yeah, I'll be happy to. And that became the Journeyman album.
I was thinking, as everyone will know who watches this, my all-time possibly all-time favourite album of all time. Certainly my favourite Eric Clapton album.
Yeah, mine too. It's a great album. And so I arrived at the Town Hall studio again when I got back, and there was Phil Collins on drums, Pino Palladino on bass, and Alan Clark on Hammond. And we put that track, we put a couple of tracks together. But
which ones are you on then?
I was on Bad Love.
Oh man.
That.
And that was that recorded in Antigua?
No, it was recorded in London at the Tate House.
Sorry, you said, yeah. I got to hold it together here and try and carry on some sort of... And you, still no butterflies then? You just... It's all in your stride at this point, is it?
Yeah,
I'm Phil Palmer.
I'd known Pino for a while already by then, and he was a friendly face, and I knew Alan as well. I think it was my first meeting with Phil Collins, but it was very relaxed, very nice. You know, we did the track and all went for lunch, and it all got on really well.
I mean, yeah, that's that. Yeah, I mean, for me, that kind of those three albums, I think, the one with Forever Man on it, which was the one before, wasn't it? Then August as well, and Journeyman. Yeah. That trilogy of albums is just... again defined a sound, I think, of a decade. It was fantastic,
and I think in a way that was just Eric checking that, you know, he didn't need me there really, but I think he wanted to check that I was able to put it together in the right way, and then he asked me to go on the tour,
and that would have been a big tour.
It's a huge tour. Yeah
And this is that kind of, yeah, it's that, for me, it was the heyday of just the amount of money that artists or record companies would throw at albums and tours.
Yeah.
And the scale of it was just, it's hard to see. Maybe tours still, some, you know, there's so much money, I suppose, it's still involved in touring, so the scale of them. But I just feel like the 80s, you know, that sense of it was okay to spend 6 months or a year or 2 years in some cases, you know, recording an album in the most expensive studio there was with the most expensive session players there was. It just doesn't happen anymore.
No, it doesn't.
And hasn't probably since the 80s.
It was still going on in through the 90s, but as technology started to take over, it was those events stopped happening.
So how did this, before we started filming, I was saying to Phil that you know, it was kind of freaky because one of the first big gigs I ever went to, I always say that, I say the best gig I ever went to was my dad took me to see Queen in 1986 for, you know, and I was 14 years old, and it just completely blew my mind. But I think the first gig that I went to, probably on my own, I definitely went with a girlfriend, but, like, you know, not with my parents, was the Nebworth thing.
Yep.
So were you, at the time, whose band were you sort of formally in to
that
go
was,
on?
That was still Eric's band.
So that was still Eric, right. So yeah. This is before the Dire Straits stuff?
Yeah. In fact, there was an interesting crossover on that day, but...
So for people that don't know, this Nebworth gig, I don't even know if it had ever really happened before... It was for Nordolf Robbins, wasn't it? A big charity thing. Whether it had ever happened before, and I suppose probably has happened since, but with maybe more sort of contemporary pop bands. But this was like a whole day of just every massive British band that there was, spanning a fair, you know, it would go from Status Quo and Cliff Richard through to Pink Floyd and Dire Straits and Eric Clapton and Genesis. And Genesis with Phil Collins singing, and Tears for Fears. Who else would have played that?
It was,
and there must have been 100,000 people, 150,000. I can't remember. It was Nebworth Bowl. Apps. there's I had the album, and it was like a double fold out album with a helicopter shot of the crowd, basically. And it's just,
I look at the back in the book.
It literally was just insane. I can literally remember where I was standing. I was standing. Oh, look, there's Frank Zappa. I don't think the shot that is.
Unless this is the one I'm talking about.
Oh, there you go. Eric Clapton in his pink suit. I remember that. I cannot believe that guitar, the red guitar there, is the guitar that that freaks me out. And it was just.
Show it to the camera.
We'll find a shot of it and we'll insert it in.
I've got
there,
the rights to the picture.
Okay, we'll find. But it was nuts, and I watched the whole gig standing. I was just there. I remember they had this huge scaffolded kind of place where the mixing console was, sort of in the middle of the crowd, and we were just to one side of that, and it was just,
you probably see yourself in that.
Oh yeah, no. With the bad haircut from 1990 for sure. We have to talk about that day. The build up and everything must have been nuts, wasn't it?
That band, Eric's band, was, I think, the best band in the world, certainly then. It was Steve Ferroni and Nathan East and Greg Fillinganes and Alan Clark and Ray Cooper and
Katie. The percussionist, right? Yeah. I can remember. So it's like, wow.
It was just a stupendous band, and I was very privileged to be part of it. But by the time we'd played Nebworth, we'd been on the road for probably a year.
Right.
Doing gigs, and I was really relaxed with it all. And it, as I say, it was such a great band to play in. And things would happen spontaneously in front of massive audiences. You know, everybody was that good that they could. If Eric did something strange, and we all followed it, and everybody would pile in, and it was a beautiful, spontaneous, organic kind of machine.
Didn't David Bowie sing at that? Have I got that? Did he do a spot?
He didn't present it, did he?
Just something came to me, and then I'm sure he was there as well. Because it was that era where everyone just had great suits, basically. There's something, I don't know, I might have got that wrong. It was 30-something years ago, but it was a good gig.
The suits, Versace suits, yeah.
Were they? Yeah. Nice. Free, or did you have to pay for them?
No, I had to pay. Mine was 3,000 quid. It was very expensive, and I got it in New York. Yeah,
wow. And that was although each sort of band did a set as such, the ending of it was everyone, wasn't it, on stage at the same time? So who were you on stage with for that sort of that last bit?
There's an important moment that happened, as we spoke about earlier, where Eric's halfway through Before You Accuse Me. Mm-hmm. Which is a 12-bar shuffle blues, really, in E. It's not rocket science, but it was a nice groove track. And he broke a string in the first solo, and he got to the second solo, and he turned around and he said, "Take it, Phil." And I spontaneously had to play a solo where I'd never played one before. As I say, it wasn't rocket science, but it was an interesting moment, and I remember the thought process was quite clear. The complication at that moment was that Eric ran off to find his guitar tech and change guitars, and I looked over to my right, and standing there next to, and they were chatting, was Mark Knopfler. All right, so there's Mark Knopfler and Eric Clapton chatting at the side of the stage while I'm playing a solo in front of 120,000 people and probably 12 million people watching it on television. And I got away with it, it was one of those things. I thought, well, if I can do that, I can do pretty much anything, And I enjoyed the moment.
I bet you did. I bet. Can we see the guitar? So, yes. Let's have a little listen. Come on.
This guy, okay.
What's the story?
I'd acquired these on the first tour with Eric in America, and I got a green one as well, which is
nice.
Quite a famous one because it's the only one of that colour. Fender asked me what colour I wanted. I said, British Racing Green with gold hardware, and it's a lovely thing, and I used it with Eric and then Dire Straits. And my guitar tech used to call them port and starboard because obviously he said, "What do you want, port or starboard?"
Yeah,
red and green. And so yeah, this became my main guitar. I liked the EC Strats because of the lace sensors, and you could get this little bit of extra fatness out of the guitar with this mid boost thing.
I thought that was Clapton's, you know, that driven tweed amplifier with the mid boost in. That was such a Clapton signature sound, you know.
Yeah, it was.
But you sound like you use it less as a drive effect and more as a fattening effect.
It's a fattening effect more than anything, yeah. I mean, sometimes the regular Strat is the cleaner sound, like Mark, for example, is a very, very beautiful thing. Mm. But, I was always a little bit frustrated. I could never get enough drive out of a regular Strat. So this came along and it's just changed all that. And I've been playing them ever since, and I use them on everything now.
And was the red one the go-to one for some reason, or is it sort of 50-50?
I think the red one has always been my favourite. I've got a black one now, which is now my favourite, but it's the same setup. And this one lives in England. I've got the green one in Italy and the black one in Italy too, and there's one that lives in France as well.
Can we, let's hear a little bit with the, you know, how you might use the mid-boost circuit that's in it.
You know, just, you know, really, there's not much drive on the amp here. It's quite compressed, but so if you want to suddenly do a nice blues solo,
Dire Straits
piece.
Yeah, I was going to maybe save the question for a bit later in the interview, but as you kind of mentioned it, then who of the kind of like the superstar guitar players that you've played and performed with, do you think sort of has influenced you the most as a player?
That's an interesting question. I mean, I think I was very influenced by Eric when I was a kid. I remember listening to Cream. And specifically, I found a solo that Eric played. I was going to ask you to play something in a minute.
Oh, okay.
On a song called
Badge. As long as it doesn't involve four different inversions of a C chord, I should be okay.
There's a song called Badge. You know, remember Badge?
Yes.
Can you play the riff?
Tum it and I'll remember it.
Okay, that's pretty much it.
This is where we need a better guitar player in there, but I'll do my best, and you're just going to little noodle over the top, are you?
Well, the solo on that song, the original version of by Cream, I was fascinated by it because it's complex. I mean, Eric's a blues player, but he managed to incorporate a kind of a blues scale in that major key, because it's very major, very happy sort of sound. And the solo he played on the original, I had to learn it. And I sat down in front of my mum's stereogram with the record, and got very good at lifting the stylus and in the right place. With my Echo acoustic, learning that solo.
Well, shall we try it?
And the reason it's so clever is that he uses a lot of semitone bends in it, and I found that really challenging. I think it is challenging for a lot of guitar players. You know, we're all used to doing, you know,
yeah,
but and getting it in tune, it's not easy.
And that, I think you hear that straight away with that Clapton thing of almost the change in key of the song. He'll use those semitone bends to just go from one mood to another in a single bend. It's very Eric Clapton.
It is.
Thing.
It's one of his tricks. Yeah. And but he does it beautifully. And so the solo of Badge. Keep going. And it's a thing of beauty.
Yes.
It's a melody within a melody. You know, it's
that. You know, I think I was in a, you know, I was working in a guitar shop during the late 80s, with Eric Clapton being my idol, and having to sort of feel like I was constantly defending him against people that were going, "Oh yeah, but Steve Vai is much better," or "Joe Satriani is much better," and I was sort of a bit like, you know. But I'm glad, in a way, I think people appreciate him more now for exactly that sense of melodic soloing, as opposed to just technically complicated soloing.
Yeah,
you know?
And you know, Eric will never play the same solo twice. And you know, we there was a moment in South America at the River Plate Stadium, Argentina, in front of, I don't know, 80,000 people, a lot of people. And right before we went on, we did the sound check, and Eric said, "Does anybody know the song Badge?"
Right. Right.
And we knocked it together real quick, and I said, "Can I do the solo? Like, can I do the first solo tonight?" And he said, "Yeah, go ahead." And so we got to the first solo, and I played his solo, that one.
Yeah.
I just played. And from the original Cream version. And there was this lovely moment between us. If there's some video somewhere, if you want to, you know, find it, it's where he's just laughing his head off because, you know, I'm looking at him and he's looking at me, and there's this lovely moment of realization what I'm up to. You know,
that's insane. I still think now that the solo off of Bad Love, some of the bends and some of the, you know, it's like
three tones.
Yeah, I mean, I've, you know, a few times that I think, come on, I'll sit down and learn this. It's just like, I'm never, you know, it's a different level, you know.
It's I don't know, it's spontaneous, that's the thing. Right. Yeah, it's never worked out. I mean,
was that the beauty of being in the studio? It's just, and you're just, you know, a few takes, and then all of a sudden the magic, and that's the one.
Pretty much, yeah.
That's
but
insane.
But, you know, live, you never hear the same solo twice. And, you know, you had to be on your toes, because depending on how you felt, you know, a solo could last, you know, in minutes rather than bars. You know, you count the minutes and you just go for it. And
well, that's what the audience is there for, isn't
exactly
it?
Exactly, and, you know, and people loved him for that. And sometimes he would fuck up, you know, because he'd just run out of ideas or run out of fretboard sometimes.
I do think, again, this is supposed to be about Phil Palmer, not Eric Clapton, but, you know, I do still kind of feel it's like it's worth taking a dive, you know, for young guitar players now. People will maybe see Eric Clapton, and they'll see perhaps the sort of the more recent stuff, and much more revisiting of very, very traditional blues, and maybe it might not be their thing. But if you look at that sort of 70s and 80s period of him, it's just like he was rock and roll.
He was on fire, yeah,
on
I must
fire.
Say. Yeah,
he was. Which is nuts. Anyway, come on, we were at Nebworth, I think.
Oh yeah.
And then you mentioned Mark Knopfler, and is that then the was that shortly after that that Mark said, you know, why don't you come and play with us for a bit?
Pretty much. We did a rehearsal for Nebworth, and we played a few tunes with Mark, and we seemed to hit it off okay. There was a connection anyway, because I mentioned Paul Brady early on. And Paul Brady was the same management as Dire Straits. A guy called Paul Cummings was mm-hmm. was the link there. So they kind of knew about me anyway. But yeah, the Nebworth show, we decided to amalgamate the two bands and have Mark come on, and John Ilsley came on, and Guy Fletcher. And we did a few Dire Straits tunes, including Money for Nothing. And did we do Sultans? I can't remember.
I can't remember. But I'm definitely going to try and dig out the double album from somewhere, though, when I get home and remember it.
And there was a track that Mark had written for someone else called I Think I Love You Too Much, which is a great tune. And we played that, and so that was my first time on the stage with Mark and Dire Straits and Eric all at the same time. And it was a joyous occasion in many ways. We got on. Mark soon after, let me just tell you the story, because I think it was important. After that event, after Nebworth, Eric continued to tour, and he was doing great business all around the world, and you know, he was doing 2-3 nights in the same venues and stuff like that around the world, and we were loving it, and the band was amazing. And then we had two events quite close together which changed everything with Eric. And one was a helicopter crash with Stevie Ray Vaughan, and the second was his son, Connor, who had a terrible accident. And I remember going to the funeral in Ripley, up the road, and a very sad day, obviously. But I had a chat with Roger Forrester, who was Eric's manager at the time. And Roger said quietly, he said, I don't think Eric's going to be doing anything for a while. So, you know, if something comes up, you should probably take it. And he said it to everybody in the band, and everyone went home and thought about it, and the first thing that came up was the Dire Straits tour, and I decided to do it, and signed a contract to do it. And literally 2 or 3 days later, I had a call from Eric saying, I'm not going to sit around doing nothing, I'm going to do an unplugged album.
Right.
Can you do it? And I had to say no. And it was a tragic day. I mean, I tried to get out of the Dire Straits tour, in actual fact, but they wouldn't let me because I'd signed the paper. And so I was kind of tied into Dire Straits for 2 years, which was, you know.
Because Andy Fairweather Lowe then did all the...
yeah, he did it after that.
Unplugged thing, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And that would be a whole... I think for a generation of people, that'll be what they know Eric for, you know, that much more laid-back, bluesy, acoustic versions of tunes. But... Oh man, I mean, it's difficult one, that one, isn't it? To sort of go, it's not like you didn't do that album and never worked again. You didn't do that album and did something else amazing, but I know what you mean. It was a pretty landmark album, that one, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. What is that, 20 million or something, that album?
I don't know. It was it was the MTV era as well, wasn't it? Of that whole... I think they say that it's that one is it the Nirvana appearance on MTV are the two most watched, you know, things of all time on MTV. But well, hey, let's talk about Dire Straits though, because I mean, again, crazy super group of a band. You know, it's just so. What was?
They were huge, yeah. But, Brothers in Arms, was it? 32 million albums.
And that song, Brothers in Arms, that's still one of those songs I borderline feel like I want to cry every time I listen to that song. It's such a beautiful...
People do, in the audiences. Yeah.
It's crazy. But yeah, and that was that... I don't know with the... So were you doing studio stuff with Dire Straits as well?
Well, an interesting thing happened after that, because I think Mark did exactly the same thing as Eric. He said, so he invited me into the studio at Air in Oxford Street, where it was then, to play on a couple of tracks that he was recording for On Every Street. And it was an interesting day. I noticed Jeff Beccaro was there on the drums that day, and you know, some great tracks on that album, some really nice playing. And he had me Okay, we had a sort of experiment going. He said you wanted me to play this little arpeggio part. He said it's quite intricate, and I want you to be exact. Right, and this is some kind of audition, really. You know, just I think not to make sure I could play. He knew that already. But to make sure that I could be precise and to follow those kind of orders. And we fiddled about with the riff for, I think I played it earlier, of On Every Street There's an Arpeggio. Which became a big moment in the set. And Mark and I would play that riff together in the middle of the stage with nothing else going on. And he had me playing that for probably 6 hours. Right? And then he would say something like, sounds not quite right. Let's find another strat. And I'd gone through all my strats, and he started bringing in some of his, and he said, play it on that one. And so I played it on a different strat, bigger neck, fatter strings, whatever. And he was recording them all on separate tracks. And the engineer's going nuts and sort of shaking. He said, "What are you doing?" And so we went through this whole process of me playing that riff all day, basically, on different strats. And in the end, we had 16 strats set up around the studio. And he said to Ron Eve, who was his guitar tech, he said, go down the warehouse and bring the black one and you know, let's try that one out. And so Ron was running around stringing up guitars and finding them. So we tried all these, went through this process, and it lasted all day. And we got to about 10 o'clock at night, I suppose, and he said, we were listening back to them and putting bits together and editing and stuff. And he said, which one do you prefer? I said, I have to be honest, I can't tell anymore. You know, we've been doing this all day. And he said to the engineer, he said, nah, I can't tell either. You choose, he said to the engineer, and went on. And that was the end of it. And, that was my audition.
I thought you were going to say, because again, when we were chatting before, you were talking about a time when I thought you were going to say they'd used all 16 as like some sort of super multi-tracked version.
No, only one version appeared.
Do you find, I hear a Mark Knopfler influence when you're playing that. Do you find it's your job as the player, as the session player, to make it sound almost as if Mark Knopfler had played it, so that when someone's listening to the record, they don't go, oh yeah, that's a different guitar player playing that bit. They just assume that Mark's played it all?
I must say, Mark never insisted. He showed me a few of his techniques, which are quite difficult to learn, but he never insisted. In fact, I've got this kind of... I prepare myself when I'm working with someone like Mark, because I never play his licks, even if I can. Mm-hmm. You know, in front of him. Mm-hmm. I think that would be a wrong thing to do. Same with Eric. I never really tried to, you know, unless he specifically said, do that here.
But I suppose he's more of a finger style guitar player than it.
That's where I came from anyway.
Right.
I wasn't influenced by Mark Knopfler. I was influenced by the same people that Mark Knopfler was influenced by.
So it's probably the other way around. It's Mark is attracted to work with you because he likes your style rather than you
possibly
going...
Possibly, or right. Understood that I was, able to do what he wanted me to do.
Yeah.
For example, this guitar influenced the way I play, you know.
It's a great interlude. I mean, it's been sitting there. It's been not the elephant in the room is the wrong word, but it's been sitting there quietly... doing just not saying its thing. We have to talk about this.
Okay.
I mean, I know it's a little bit of a detour from where we were going, but there's some history and some.
There is. And this was a present. Well, I say a present. I mean, back in the early 70s, the Kinks were working in America all the time, and it's back in the days where you could find guitars in junk stores, and people that. Hocked them or whatever, and he came across this one, and and he came back with like three or four really great guitars, including his original Flying V, which was, I love that guitar, Gibson Flying V, and a Les Paul Junior with one pickup, which I also love, same colour. And he was farting around with them, and this one was a bit beat up. You know, it's a little bit beat up, really. It needed some work doing on the frets. The frets were worn out, so I had it refretted. And he said, "Well, take that one away. Have that one. You know, if you like it." And I did. I loved it. I mean, I fell in love with it. It changed the way I played this guitar. I mean, this guitar is responsible for my style, if you like, because you can do things with it you can't do with other guitars. I mean, I used to listen to a guy called Roy Buchanan, do you remember him?
All those, and the behind it, all that stuff, very cool.
And that was my influence, he was my influence. Roy Buchanan and Scotty Moore, was it? Pickers, you know, country pickers. Even Chet Atkins, as we said earlier. Influenced my style a lot. So this guitar really chose me in a way. It's a bit like the concept of the Harry Potter wand. You know, the wand chooses the wizard rather than the other way around.
You are impossibly modest, because you've managed to tell the whole story of this guitar without actually going, it's an original 51 No Custom.
It is, yeah, 1951.
With all the original bits. Oh, I say you changed the pickups, but the original pickups are in the case.
No, I changed the volume.
Oh, the volume, right, so that's the all. Pickups, right, so it's just the knobs.
It's all original, and apart from that volume pot, which became impossible to use, because it just...
You've got the original bridge cover as well.
It's in the case.
And
over there.
You know, you say it's beaten up. It's not that beaten up.
Well, not
the neck's 70, incredibly good, Nick.
70 years old, it's not bad.
I mean, with the providence behind that, I know it's, you know, vulgar to discuss things like that, but that's possibly one of the most valuable guitars. I mean, it's going to be up there with I imagine, something like, you know, Bernie Marsden's Les Paul or Peter Green's Les Paul. But yeah, and show the back.
Yeah, this on the back is interesting. It puzzled me for a long time. I don't know if you can see it on the camera. It says Carl, C-A-R-L. And it was obviously put on there a long time ago to protect the varnish, or to protect the finish on the back. And I was lucky enough to do a gig with Carl Perkins at the Albert Hall. And I took this along and I said, do you recognise that? He said, God damn. He said, I haven't seen that in a while. So it's probably, it was his at some point. I don't know how it found its way into a junk store in New York. But David bought it in New York and brought it back. And so we did a bit of research on it. We had it refretted at Roker's. There's
Roker's on Denmark Street.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Roker's did the refret. And in the case somewhere, there's a receipt for a top nut, £1.75. £1.17 shillings and sixpence, maybe.
Wow. I mean, I'm not, you don't sound like the sort of person that's particularly, like, its value as a collectible thing doesn't sound like it's terribly important to you. Its value as a tool and as an instrument sounds like it's more important, which half of me feels is just like, it's super refreshing because that is what it is. But you must, you're holding in your hands there probably the price of a two-bedroom flat somewhere. In Guildford, you know, it's like that is...
It may come to that someday, I don't know, but
It's just, I mean, it is amazing to, and you know, just for the viewers, Pete's played it, and so I'm sure he'll talk about that in a subsequent video and how it compares with his purple one, but I think you liked it, right, Pete?
Yeah. It's incredible.
It's amazing.
It is marvellous. It affects the way you play. Well, it affected the way I play. Mm. I really love the story, by the way. I don't know if it's a myth of any description, but... Roy Buchanan, who I mentioned earlier, had one very similar to this, except he had a hole drilled through there, like a quarter inch hole, quite a big hole, where he used to hang it on a nail. He used to hang it on a nail in his house.
I still love that, because again, you know, I mean, this is, my dad started the music store in 64, and I've said, you know, I said, oh, Dad, if only you'd kept some of the instruments, you'd, and he's just like, well, what were we supposed to feed ourselves with then? You know, it's just like, they were just bits of wood that you sold to guitar players to go and strum around on. There was no sense that, you know, 70 years time they'd be heirlooms, you know. Lovely bit of story on that, and I'm, you know, honoured that we've all had a bit of a strum on it, and it's lovely.
It's a good thing. It's got a smell. Did you notice that?
There's something
about, maybe I'm just weird, but I love the smell of old guitars, and you open the case, the original case too, and it's got this history comes out in an aroma. It's amazing.
It's amazing. Okay, so back on track here, because I know we've still got one or two, maybe more, crazy level artists. So let's, Dire Straits, amazing sessions, touring, crazy. That presumably comes to an end at some point or other, and you move on to the next thing. So, you know, we must be, where are we at now?
Mid-90s.
Mid-90s now.
Yeah, because the Straits finished in 92, 93.
Right.
And after that, I kind of wandered around the session circuit again for a while. But at a higher level, because, you know, with a pedigree like, you know, the Straits and Eric, you know, it was, in fact, it was a strange one, because people suddenly say, oh, he won't want to do my session, and I really did, you know, or it would be too expensive for me now, you know. So that all went on, but, you know, I managed to persuade people that I wasn't gonna cost too much, and I was willing to do it, so... So I went back into the session circuit, and we did some great stuff, you know. And we did a lot of house band things, and big charity events at that point, you know, with people like Pino and Phil Collins, and it was a house band kind of thing. And we did some very interesting events in that format, including the show for Montserrat.
I've seen that as well on TV. That was a big...
massive.
Didn't George Martin organise that? That was his thing, wasn't it?
It was his thing, yeah.
And again, everyone was at that, weren't they?
Everyone.
Was that on Montserrat?
No, it was at the Albert Hall.
Right, okay, because I remember going to Montserrat on a day trip when we were in the Caribbean with my wife, you know, just as and thinking to myself, it's mad to think that there'd be there's a studio on this island somewhere, because it's a tiny, tiny island, isn't it? So there was a big... That's right, because it was the volcano, wasn't it?
That's right.
To raise money for the, of course.
That's right.
Trying to remember. So that was a crazy big gig, wasn't it?
It was a fabulous gig, and it was, I think, maybe the first time I worked with Paul McCartney. And we did a Beatles medley for four or five songs, one of which was Hey Jude. And it was a point when I'm strumming guitar in Hey Jude, which is an F, I think, and Paul McCartney's singing it, and I'm thinking... This is bizarre.
It's up there, right?
Yeah.
It's just, do you have grandchildren to tell these stories to?
I have a young granddaughter, yes, she's two.
Oh, I hope she appreciates it when she gets a bit older and just, she thinks she's got the probably coolest granddad of them all.
That's one of the reasons I wanted to write the book, you know, for that.
That's amazing. So, I mean, I've got... You know, some of the biggest... You mentioned... I say you didn't mention, because you're so too modest to mention anything. I read somewhere that did some George Michael stuff.
Oh, yeah, George, yeah.
I mean, doesn't... Again, a bit of a... Not necessarily the same audience as Dire Straits, but it's, you know, arguably the, you know, one of the greatest male singers of all time, and, you know, certainly in his peak, didn't come any bigger than that, so...
No, it's true, he didn't. My first... job with George was for an album called Listen Without Prejudice, which was the album after Faith, after the album that Faith was on anyway, and it was his first proper solo album, and it was quite a weird project, because it was stage one of an album, so basically George had ideas for songs rather than, you know, organised parts and stuff. So I would get called in to strum, to find a pattern to strum to, with some chords that he kind of evolved over the space of an evening. And it would be me and a click track, or even a drum machine sometimes, just, you know, the initial stages of songs. And him and Chris Porter would take it away for a few days and develop it, edit it, and you know, develop it into a song structure. And then I would come back and play it again in the structure that they've organised. So, mm-hmm. But it was always me alone on the original tracks of a lot of those things. I mean, tracks like Freedom 90. You know.
Yeah, what was... Again, I certainly remember Faith coming out and I was still probably just finishing school. And then Listen Without Prejudice came out, and if I remember rightly, that was he'd come out and he was like, take me as I am, you know, and it was quite a...
He didn't come out officially.
Did he not? No, I thought, was it the next one then? There was a point at which he sort of went from going, I'm going to be the Careless Whisper guy, to I'm going to be this much more opinionated person, and you know, okay, but I just maybe, but I find it, you know, get really complicated character by the sounds of things, you know, yeah, and obviously a pretty tragic ending.
Yeah, totally.
But what was he like as a person to work with?
He was the boss, you know. He never crossed the line into friendship. I didn't.
Right, okay.
I don't think anybody really did. I was talking to his engineer of 30 years, a guy called Niall, yesterday, because they're putting together all the tracks. They're re-recording, remixing the tracks and remastering them. And, you know, he felt the same way as I did. You know, you never crossed that line. I mean, if George invited you to his house, then you would go, but you know, because it was socially acceptable. But you'd never cross the line into being a friend. I mean, there's only one guy that I can ever remember that was able to cross that line, and that's Danny Cummings, the percussionist. And he had a great relationship with George, and they had, you know, Danny could take the piss out of George and get away with it, yeah, you know, because he would make George laugh. But he's one of the few people that could. So it was not, I wouldn't say it was a friend, although we did work together for 30 years.
Did you, so you must have been in the, you know, were you in sessions where he would sing and you were, so I mean, was that, because I just think he's an unbelievable vocalist, you know, just, was that spine tingly kind of stuff or are you just another,
it was another
person
thing,
that you worked with?
Yeah. I mean, he was... He would fix a lot of stuff afterwards, I mean, like we all did.
You know, right.
And track things up to make them sound great and stuff. And it was interesting dissecting the tracks yesterday and listening to the backing vocals on Faith, for example, which are just a big block of him.
Right.
You know, maybe 12 tracks of different voicings and different takes. And it's a fascinating process, but he was meticulous about how he did things, but... not always brilliant, honestly. Not always.
Well, I suppose it's...
He was human.
Yeah, absolutely. And I suppose the end product... I remember him singing at that Freddie Mercury tribute concert and the stuff
amazing.
With Aretha Franklin and stuff. And I'm guessing that's not fixed. That's just...
No, that's not fixed.
And it's just...
He was very proud of that moment.
Gravy, you know.
Very proud of that moment when he sang the Queen song. We had to hold the long note at the end.
Yeah, well, come on, Anderson, think what it is. Somebody to love.
Somebody to love.
Yeah. Mental.
He was very proud of that moment because he was shitting himself before that show. He said, this is a high note. It's right at the top of my range and I've got to really hold it. And he did it, and he did it great. You know, it's all power to him. Really.
Were you on stage for that show as well?
No, I wasn't there.
I was waiting for that one, thinking.
I wasn't there for that one.
That was the one that you didn't do. Okay, fair enough. So, you know, and again... So career-wise, then, did you keep working with kind of powerhouse acts like that through into the 90s and into the noughties, or has there been a sort of a sense of taking it a little step backwards and going right, slow the pace down a little
bit? Not deliberately, no. the record industry changed during the 90s, and that's when I first started working with Trevor Horn. And we developed a nice understanding. Trevor Horn is an interesting guy because he came from the same roots as I did. He was a session bass player,
right?
Before he became, you know, a successful producer, whatever. And he still plays bass. So we had quite a lot in common, but you know, his approach to recording was quite different to what everyone else was doing. I mean, people, I saw a quote the other day that Trevor Horn invented the 80s. And I think, in a way, it's probably true, because he was doing great stuff with Seal and Grace Jones and all that stuff. I mean, Slave to the Rhythm, what a track that is.
And, yeah, I mean, and work, he deserves some sort of MBE just for working with Grace Jones, doesn't he?
So. Yeah, she was not an easy lady. But, you know, great records, great ideas and fabulous sounds and stuff. Mm. But it, you know, the industry was changing. We were, you know, we'd gone from analog to digital, so everything was edited in a different way, and you know, suddenly all these possibilities became available to record producers and musicians that it didn't have before. Mm. You know, before digital, it was a razor blade and a on a piece of tape. You know, that's what editing was back then. So yeah, the editing became easier. The sampling started to happen. The MIDI started to happen. All that stuff was suddenly revolutionised the music industry. The Lin drum appeared, and drummers started going out of business and losing gigs. And then suddenly there was an extra person on recording sessions called a programmer. You know, what does a programmer do? Yeah. Initially, we thought, okay, but it was just a guy who was there who could put the track together on a computer, and you'd play to it. You'd play to a template often during that period, and you know, the producer or the artist or the programmer would put a template together of the entire track with a guide bass and a guide drum kit and sometimes a guide guitar, guide piano, you know, and then they would get musicians in to play it. And that's how it started. That was the gradual decline of the session circuit.
Do you think that there was a period of time where just the guitar became marginalised as well in music, and just therefore there wasn't the opportunity? Or?
It was the most difficult thing to synthesise. I mean, you could get a believable piano sound and eventually a good bass sound from a machine, but guitars were always a little bit more complicated to... You know, there's so many variants inside the sound of an acoustic guitar, for example. And they didn't get that right for a long time. I think they probably have now.
So what was that... I mean, were you comfortable in the sense of... Did you feel like, you know, you'd built up your PPL kind of royalties and you'd, you know, you'd obviously, from an ambition point of view, you know, there wasn't many things left to sort of tick, you know, that you hadn't done. Was it quite a comfortable sense of going, look, you know, it's fine if my career is going to go in a different direction now, I'm cool with that? Or was it more
it's a gradual process, you know, it was probably over 10 15 years.
Oh, so okay.
It didn't happen overnight. It was a very gradual thing. But during those years working with Trevor, I was often the token human on sessions, you know, to someone to come in to mess it up a bit because it was too polite or too correct or you know, without groove or whatever. And I did a lot of sessions in that period. Yeah.
Who were you working with? I can think of a few massive bands that you know Trevor produced, but who were you involved with?
I did the Pet Shop Boys,
right?
Which I loved. They're great, those two.
Yeah.
Neil, isn't it?
Yeah.
So I did with Trevor. We did Lisa Stansfield. We did
lots of. They're all not. Maybe not so much the Pet Shop Boys, but was there a sense there was? It never quite got like that sort of Stock Aitken Waterman kind of thing. But there was definitely. They all had like a produced pop sound, and was that. You know, I can't think of one of those bands where you go, yeah, that had that guitar riff in it that you can, you know, that hook that was recognised. They were all guitars as much more of a just a fill out the background a little bit.
Yeah, that's pretty true actually. That's pretty accurate.
But did it? I mean, you come across as you know, at the end of the day, if you want me to do a session where you turn me right down in the mix versus a session where I'm front and centre, you don't care. It's just do what you get paid to do.
Yeah, it's my job. Working with George was often like that. I mean, I wouldn't say it was a rewarding musical experience working with George Michael. You know, apart from him, you know, he was the whole thing. But if I did anything on a George Michael session too intricate or too important, he would say, "Don't do it."
Right.
Because it's distracting from my voice. And he was very honest about it, and he was probably very right too at the same time. But don't do anything too distracting. Just play the part, and don't be clever, because I don't want to be overshadowed in any way.
It's his prerogative, isn't it?
Absolutely.
I'm sure he's not the only singer that's attained that level of success and worked the musicians like that as well. Bring us up to speed then. You know what? I know you live in Italy now and have done for 10 years or so.
Yeah.
What, you know, are you, you know, have you tried to write some of your own stuff and get that out of your system?
Yes.
And
yes,
sort of, you know,
that's been happening. Although I haven't committed to a solo album yet.
Right.
I've always avoided that. I said, I don't want to do that. You know, it's for people like Jeff Beck, or, you know, they're the ones that do solo albums. I'm not known enough, really, I don't think. But
would it be an instrumental album, or can you sing a little bit?
I do sing now. Mm-hmm. I do sing. It's something that I've developed over the last few years, because you know, you have to reinvent yourself during these periods of change. You know, you can't just hope that it's all going to come back again, because it won't. So I started writing a lot. And production as well. And I did a lot of that in Italy, and I worked a lot with a guy called Renato Zero, who's probably the Italian Elton John,
right?
That kind of level.
Yeah,
a very important artist in Italy. And we did over the last few years, we've done 2 albums, and I've written 16 or 17 of the songs. So, you know, I've reinvented myself as a writer. And during the process of demoing all those songs, I sang.
Mm-hmm.
And I started to quite enjoy it. Yeah. So, who knows?
Well, honestly, tell us about the book. Come on, because I feel like, you know, we've only met today. I feel like you're the sort of person I could spend, you know, I could meet over and over and over again and still enjoy hearing stories and stuff. And there's just no ego with you at all, you know, which is lovely in this. And then sometimes you sit there going, you know, you don't sell yourself at all, really, I don't think. So, but tell us about the book, because I kind of feel, was this a, you know, you mentioned you've got 2-year-old granddaughter, and some of it was about getting it down so that, you know, perhaps, you know, she'll be able to know a little bit more about
it. And my kids, my own kids, you know, are both in their 30s now.
Are you as modest with them as you have been? You know, are they going to be hearing stuff in this interview going...
They used to take the piss out of me for what I did for a living, when they were kids. They did. Because, I'm prone, when I'm playing solo, I might pull a face. They said, "What are you doing that for, Daddy?" Yeah, stuff like that, as you do. Musicians pull faces. And I think when they were at school, they started to understand that what I did for a living was actually quite cool. Because from their friends, you know, it was my job, and I disappeared for months on end while they were growing up. And I think they resented music because of that, in a way. But they started to understand that, you know, where I'd been and what I'd done was quite important. So they were part of the incentive to write the book. Apart from, as described in the book, I had a very strange moment. I was on tour in Brazil with a guy called Eros Ramazzotti, who's an Italian artist. And it was a pretty intense few days. And we'd arrived back at the hotel in Sao Paulo at 3 a.m. and we had to leave again at 5 to get a plane to go somewhere else. So I just I laid on the bed with all my clothes. I brushed my teeth, packed my bag, and laid on the bed with my clothes and waited for the phone to ring, or the alarm to go off. And I went into this weird trance, and it never happened since. And it was a very strange kind of moment. It was a was like having a video machine with my life on it and a remote control. And I was able to fast forward and pause and go back and, you know. And it just, this intense amount of information was flooding into my memories of things I'd long forgotten. Memories of my child when I was four, childhood. Early music inspiration and stuff like that. And I was woken up out of this kind of weird trance, and all this stuff is going on. I thought, I've got to start writing this down. So I picked up the phone and I started working on the phone, you know. At the same time, it was like a a weird premonition, because, you know, if you see your life flashing before you, you think maybe something bad's going to happen any minute, you know. And we had a flight in South America and blah, 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 and the weather wasn't good. And I thought, oh, God, what's going on? But it was like that. It was, my life was flashing before me, and I managed to, you know, write a lot of it down, the key moments, on my phone over the next few days, and then I transferred everything to computer. And then it was a weird thing, because as you open one door into a memory, there's other doors inside the memory, and you keep going inside it. And it became a book.
Well, I will put a link to where you can buy this below. I think you can get it as, obviously, as a regular printed copy or as an ebook, but I'll put links below where you can get that. It's honestly, it almost feels a shame to sort of go, you know, and that's a wrap kind of thing, because I bet you we're going to go and have some lunch after this in the pub. And I bet you go, oh, of course, and then there was this time that I worked with massive artist named, and I completely forgot to tell you about that time.
I've forgotten about Robbie Williams and Take That. I mean, that's what I was doing in the 90s.
Yeah, well, I mean, that was small, wasn't it? And no wonder you forgot about it. I mean, hey, you know what? I'm going to leave it there. You're going to have to buy the book if you want to find out about that. Or you're going to have to come back and do part two.
I'm game.
But look, thank you so much for watching. Thank you so much for coming in.
It's honestly
been an absolute pleasure. It's half as much fun just watching Pete's face and Oz's face behind the camera as all the stories are coming out. But I hope you've enjoyed it. I know it's been a long one, this one, but, you know, it is what it is. I hope you've enjoyed it. And thank you so much, Phil. It's been
my absolute pleasure. See you all again.
Yeah, thanks a lot. See you guys. Bye-bye. Thanks for listening to our latest podcast. If you enjoyed it, hit that subscribe button. See you next time.